Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to have a very interesting conversation for the next hour. I'm pleased to be able to present to you a man that I've come to know a bit and admire greatly for his past service to our country, notably in Vietnam, where he worked on a very interesting program known as CORDS. We're going to talk with him about what CORDS involved, what it stood for, what it accomplished as part of a larger tableau we're going to paint with his help. We're doing this just about 50 years to the day after Henry Kissinger, time the National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, as I recall, under Richard Nixon, concluded the so-called Paris Peace Accords with the North Vietnamese. The tableau, which is part of a book that will be published very shortly, entitled Kissinger's Betrayal, How We Lost the Vietnam War, is a remarkable study of a story that has been wholly inadequately told to this point. We didn't lose the Vietnam War on the battlefields of Vietnam. The South Vietnamese, for that matter, didn't, up to a point. And that point was where they were sold out by Henry Kissinger and, to be fair, the Democratic-controlled Congress that had turned very sharply against. The author of this new book, Kissinger's Betrayal, is Stephen Young. He has been involved over the years in researching this matter deeply, including with, interestingly enough, as we'll hear shortly, Richard Nixon himself. He has also been very actively engaged in efforts to try to learn the lessons of Vietnam and spare ourselves a reprise of that disaster, which, unfortunately, despite his best efforts, has now befallen not just us, but the people of Afghanistan as well. Steve Young, it's great to have you with us. Congratulations on the imminent publication of this important new book. I've been watching you incubating it and writing it for some years now, and I couldn't be more pleased that it's about available, I hope, for pre-order right now. But I want to give you the opportunity to sort of set the stage for this saga, especially against the backdrop of the past 50 years since Kissinger's betrayal.
Thanks, Frank. It's an honor and a privilege, and it's important to be on your program. Let me try very briefly to encapsulate, especially for your younger viewers, sort of Vietnam. The core theme that I think has been overlooked, and in fact, it was denied by the anti-war movement, but we now know in retrospect, it was the core theme, which is this concept of nationalism, Vietnamese nationalism. Why the Vietnamese people themselves never wanted to be ruled by the communists. Why they were willing to fight for what we Americans understand is, you know, freedom, democracy, my family, my religion, against people who want to tell me how to live my life. The original American commitment way back in 1954, there was a letter from President Eisenhower to the head of South Vietnam, the newly created South Vietnam, talking about nationalism. We want to help you as Vietnamese. And we even turned our backs on the French colonialists who had run Vietnam as part of their colonial empire. Hanoi invades illegally, starting in 1959, and they cover it up with a sort of a guerrilla movement, and they create a political fiction supported by the French, And there's an interesting French connection between the French colonialist and Henry Kissinger, by the way. So John Kennedy goes to the aid of the nationalists in South Vietnam in a limited fashion with advisors, economic aid, military equipment, things like that. Hanoi escalates. The then governor of South Vietnam, there was lots of tension because they're under attack. A good man, but a weak man, is overthrown. There's sort of political confusion. End of 1963, Hanoi escalates again and starts sending down its own troops, sending more, building up the southern Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, we call them. In 65, Hanoi has got regular units in there. The South Vietnamese army is weak. Lyndon Johnson decides we will not let the South Vietnamese people. Johnson, he was never given enough credit for this. He was always concerned about the people. It's the same mind and spirit as the Great Society here. He sent American combat forces in to hold the line, which we did. Then in late 66, Johnson understands that the war has to be turned over to the Vietnamese people. Nationalism again. So he then starts planning to withdraw American forces, but build up the South Vietnamese army and pay more attention to the people in the villages, the rural people, to defeat the insurgency, to defeat the Viet Cong. That program was the Cords program, which I worked on. By 1972, both things under Richard Nixon, both programs had been successful. The Cords program had defeated the Viet Cong. The South Vietnamese army, now about 1 million men. I mean, that's a lot of people. The nationalists were able to mobilize 1 million men. They had another 1 million citizens, men and women, in the villages in self-defense militias. The basis for the struggle was in the villages, people against the communists in their home communities. And then the South Vietnamese army held off a North Vietnamese invasion in 1972. At that point, Henry Kissinger pulls out of his hat.
That was with the support of American air power, right?
At this point, it's important to remember, I think, the American support was basically air power. Hanoi sends its entire army into the South in the late spring of 72. The South Vietnamese do all the ground fighting, and we support them with air power. And the combination of that stops Hanoi, stops them cold. Then Henry Kissinger pulls out this peace agreement, which, to the surprise of everybody and to the fury of the South Vietnamese, leaves Hanoi's army inside the South.
So just hold the thought for a second, Steve. You say he pulled this out. He had been conducting secret negotiations up to that point. Is that right?
Yes, Frank.
So this was a sort of covert operation on the part of Kissinger in collusion with the North Vietnamese, aided and abetted by this French colonialist. Huh?
Exactly. There were two levels, I mean, for the audience to understand, of the secret negotiations. There was the so-called middle level, which he discussed with President Nixon and Ambassador Bunker and President Thieu of South Vietnam, but held secret from the Defense Department, the State Department, and the American people. There was a lower level of secrecy, which was Henry Kissinger himself individually with the North Vietnamese using this French guy whose name was Jean Saint-Denis. And at this lower level, this darker level of secrecy, I think the documents that I have found show that not even Richard Nixon knew what Kissinger was doing.
Wow. And we're going to have to take a short break here, Steve. When we come back, I want you to brief us on those documents, the smoking guns, if you will, documenting Henry Kissinger's betrayal, not just of the Vietnamese, not just of the men and women in the United States military who had fought and bled and in some cases died in Vietnam, but of his own boss, Richard Nixon, President of the United States. We'll be right back with more with the author of Kissinger's Betrayal, Steve Young, right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Army Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long deserves the first Congressional Medal of Honor for non-combat-related heroism under intense fire. Together with three other military whistleblowers, she has exposed the extensive, often fatal, and intensifying damage being done to our armed forces personnel by so-called COVID-19 vaccines. Colonel Long recently told Epoch Times that Pentagon data concerning critical groups within the uniformed services has revealed that, quote, there is a statistically significant increase in death, permanent harm, or severe temporary harm in young, healthy, fit pilots, unquote. The military's shameful response has been to relieve Dr. Long of her duties, and even worse, to cook the books, altering the evidence to try to conceal its frightening implications for not just the troops, but everyone who has been jabbed. Thankfully, Senator Ron Johnson has been helping the whistleblowers, but he and they need our support, too. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We are conducting in this hour a, well, sneak preview of a very important book that will be published shortly by Real Clear Press. It's entitled Kissinger's Betrayal: How We Lost the Vietnam War. Its author is Stephen Young. He is a remarkable man of letters, an historian, champion of freedom, who was himself in the front lines of the Vietnam War, in a sense, namely the home front in Vietnam, with a project called CORDS. And Steve, you mentioned that it successfully defeated the Viet Cong. Remind us what the acronym stands for and how that was done, and then we'll come back to what Henry Kissinger was doing to sell them all out.
All right. So, Hanoi, I thought, and others have thought, learned a lesson from the Korean War. In the Korean War, the North Koreans just invaded with a traditional army across a border, violating the United Nations and international law. So in Vietnam, after the French left, there were two countries, North and South, just like Korea, North and South. Only this time, the North Vietnamese were clever. They didn't send their army across the border. They sent agents. They infiltrated agents into the rural areas and the mountains to organize South Vietnamese to turn against their own government. We now have, Frank, and this is maybe actually the most important thing in this book I have, we have English translations of the North Vietnamese orders from the Communist Politburo to the people in the South to organize this guerrilla movement. And the anti-war movement for years said, oh no, this is a lie, this is a big lie, the government is lying to us. There's no invasion from North Vietnam. Now we got the documents. Hanoi published them, Merle Primanowitz translated them into English. I put them in the book. They picked up-
Let me just make one point clear. You said the North didn't invade. They used these Viet Cong forces as proxies for an invasion. In due course, they did invade, of course, with regular army forces. But during this critical period, what you and others involved with CORDS were contending with was the threat that those Viet Cong represented to the villagers who populated much of South Vietnam, right?
Most of the South Vietnamese people lived in villages. So the communists in Hanoi created the name National Liberation Front, or the Front for the Liberation of South Vietnam. That was a sort of a longer name. The Vietnamese themselves called that, the communist movement, the Viet Cong, which is Vietnamese for Vietnamese communists. And then the Americans, the journalists and the soldiers, we call it the VC. So those were the names that were used back then. And they were very powerful, and they destabilized the country down to 65, 66. But even the VC, were not enough, Frank. So Hanoi, in early 65 in particular, began sending down regiments of its regular army. The CORDS program was started really by Richard Nixon, by Lyndon Johnson, and then picked up by Richard Nixon in 67.
Interesting. And remind us what CORD stands for.
Is Civil Operations Rural Development Support. The man who came up with this was a genius whom we've forgotten, Robert Comer. And what he saw is you had to integrate horizontally. You had to integrate politics with the military. So civilians and military people had to come together. And by the way, people should remember that that's what Clausewitz, the great military historian and analyst, said. You can never separate politics from the military. Secondly, you needed a vertical integration. The Saigon government in Saigon had to reach down all the way down to the smallest villages and hamlets throughout the country. So you do this. You have the horizontal integration and the vertical integration. You build power of the people, and the Viet Cong basically evaporated. By January 1973.
You know, it's ironic. The left was constantly talking about power to the people, and this is an example of doing exactly just that, right?
Exactly. In fact, I once wrote an article. I mean, because I've been kind of, when I was in college, some of my friends were in SDS, so I sort of was hanging out with them, and this power to the people thing. And then later on, I wrote an article about how SDS, total talk in the U.S., but in Vietnam, we delivered power to the people. Tom Hayden.
And just tell me what your role was again.
I was two things. I was a deputy. I spent a year learning the Vietnamese language. The CORD set up a language training program, something we never really did in either Iraq or Afghanistan. And so I had a year. And then so then I was sent to work in the villages. I was in two districts in the Mekong Delta. In Binh Long province, I was a deputy district advisor with a small team. Then I had some ideas about strengthening village government, kind of like in the American tradition, the old New England village town meeting where the people run their local communities. The Vietnamese in history, before the French, it turns out, they had a similar local institution. So anyway, so I was talking about that, and my reward was to have the boss of the program, William Colby, who later became head of the CIA, pulled me out of the villages and turned me into a bureaucrat. And we had a phrase for people who worked in Saigon. It wasn't very nice, rather vulgar. But that gave me, my job was to integrate between the Americans and the South Vietnamese government around the power of village governments.
Okay, so talk a little bit about how this strategy was actually embraced by the people in those villages and what it did to actually empower them and give them the capacity to fight off and ultimately defeat the Viet Cong.
Right. Before you get that, well, one key point, which I haven't seen reported anywhere, is that in January 1973, when Kissinger has sold us out, right, the defense attaché's office in the embassy, they keep an order of battle, which I'm sure some of your listeners know about. Order of battle is the number of enemy troops in which units. For the independent Viet Cong units in the entire country of South Vietnam, they gave them credit for having 26,000 soldiers. That's nothing. The South Vietnamese, as I said, have mobilized 1 million men in the army at various levels, another 1 million in self-defense forces. The VC at this point have only 26,000 men left under their own label. There were other soldiers, but they've all been integrated into North Vietnamese military units. So the CORD's idea was basically you trust local people. They had their own village governments. You give village governments power. What kinds of power? You give the villagers political power to elect their village council and their village chief. You then give the council and the chief the power to do economic development. I set up a village credit program, for example. 2,200 villages in Vietnam had a credit program run by the local council. So if some local lady wants to borrow 10,000 piastres to buy a sow so she can start having baby pigs, and she sells off two or three of the baby pigs, she pays back her loan, she pays it back to the village, not to some banker. And then they can loan it to another lady who wants to buy chickens. And then self-defense. The government would put a platoon or a squad of government soldiers in the village, but the village had to organize its own self-defense force. And as the villagers saw the economy was getting better, that they had some power and control over their destiny. And they had their local religions, shrines, Buddhist temples, Kaodai temples, etc. the people in the village would talk to their sons and grandsons and nephews in the VC and say, what are you guys doing? The government then had a welcome program to the members of the VC. Say, if you come back, no problem. We'll give you sort of political orientation. And then you can go back to your village and join the village self-defense force. And I think between 67, something like 200,000 VC deserted the communists and came back to the government side. That's really what happened to the collapse of the VC.
This is extraordinary. And I want people to hold on to the thought of what was done in this case, because it's going to be directly relevant to a topic we'll turn to a little later in the program, how we lost Afghanistan as a result of Joe Biden's surrender and the failure to adopt a Accords-style program to help there. Hold the thought, Steve Young. We'll be right back with more, including the promised documents that show us Henry Kissinger's betrayal that cost us the Vietnam War. Right after this. Stay tuned.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Steve Young, the author of a forthcoming book entitled Kissinger's Betrayal, How We Lost the Vietnam War. We're having this conversation within a day or two of the 50th anniversary of Henry Kissinger's betrayal. And to chronicle what that betrayal entailed and to document it, I'm very pleased to have Steve now share with us the evidence that he has painstakingly pulled together of what Kissinger did and the myriad people that he betrayed in the process. So walk us through this saga as you've
seen. Thanks, Frank. Let's pick up where we left off. The success of Accords, the growing power of the South Vietnamese. While this is happening, when I was still in Saigon, feeling very good about our progress, on January 9, 1971, people should remember the date. This is early. This is not when the crunch comes, you know, around the election of 1972. This is January 9, 1971. Kissinger has a meeting with Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin. Part of their meeting is to talk about the problems with Berlin, the nuclear arms race, things like that. Towards the end of it, they talked about Vietnam. And we have now Dobrynin's report to his foreign ministry about his meeting with Kissinger. We have Dobrynin quoting Kissinger. I'd like to point out for you in the audience, this is not an American document. This is not something that's been doctored up by who knows whom, right? This is a Russian document sent in code to his foreign ministry in Moscow. We now have an English translation years later. So Dobrynin writes, this is what Kissinger says. The president, Richard Nixon, is still determined to retaliate against North Vietnam, but he knows that one of the key issues to which North Vietnam attaches great importance is the issue of withdrawal of U.S. troops. He, Kissinger, and the president are currently discussing with each other this possibility. That's what Kissinger says. What if the U.S. were to commit to withdraw all of its troops by some absolutely specific deadline of which they would inform the Vietnamese? At the same time, the Americans could refrain from demanding a reciprocal withdrawal of North Vietnamese troops from South Vietnam. In other words, we take our troops home, Hanoi gets to leave its army inside South Vietnam. And then a little while later, Dobrynin says, Kissinger made a rather curious remark that ultimately it will no longer be there the Americans' concern, but that of the Vietnamese themselves, if sometime after the U.S. troop withdrawal, they start fighting with each other again. In other words, he's telling the National Security Advisor of the United States is telling the Soviet ambassador that we will wash our hands of the South Vietnamese people. And once we pull our troops out, they're on their own. Now, I'd like to read this for the audience. Okay, so this is Henry Kissinger's report to President Richard Nixon of the same meeting. This is what Henry Kissinger tells his president. I'm just going to read it, Frank, because it's the words speak for themselves, frankly. We then turn to Vietnam. I said to Dobrynin that we had read Kosygin's interview with the Japanese newspaper with great interest. We had noticed that Kosygin had listed the usual unacceptable Hanoi demands, but he had also indicated a Soviet willingness to engage itself in the process of a settlement. This was stated, it seemed to me, more emphatically than had been in the past. Was I correct? Dobrynin merely said that he noticed the sentence also. I asked whether the two statements were linked. In other words, whether the Soviet willingness to engage itself was linked to our prior acceptance of Hanoi's demands. Dobrynin then said he wanted to ask me a hypothetical question. If Hanoi dropped its demands for a coalition government, would we be prepared to discuss withdrawal separately? I said as long as the matter was hypothetical, it was very hard to form a judgment. But I could imagine that the issue of withdrawals was a lot easier to deal with than the future composition of a government in the South. Indeed, if you remembered an article I had written in 1968, I had proposed exactly this procedure. Dobrynin asked whether I still believed that this was a possible approach. I said it certainly was a possible approach, and indeed, I had been of the view that it would have been the one that would speed up matters. Dobrynin said he would report this to Moscow. At the end of the meeting, Dobrynin gave me an art book with an inscription for my son, since he had read somewhere that my son was very interested in art. Now, Frank, I ask you, where in Kissinger's report to Nixon does he tell the truth about what he proposed to the Russians?
Namely, that the United States would withdraw entirely and essentially wash its hands of South Vietnam and the Vietnamese people, and take no exception to the fact that the North Vietnamese would be able to remain in force in South Vietnam. That's the essence of the deal that he was proposing to strike with the North Vietnamese. Is that right?
And that, Frank, and the American people need to know that. That was the deal that was in the Paris Peace Agreement 50 years ago on January 27, 1973, the same deal.
And you're saying that Richard Nixon not only knew nothing of this, but was not in favor of such an arrangement?
When Nixon, anybody can go to look to the history books that the State Department has put out, Foreign Relations of the United States, and remarkably, in this case, it's a benefit. We have the tapes. We have the famous Nixon tapes. So the State Department has put in these books the transcriptions of the meetings between Kissinger and Nixon in October, November, December of 1972 in January, where Nixon kind of learns this. And I put in my
just for clarity's sake, these were covertly recorded.
Yes.
Kissinger was not aware he was being taped.
Maybe. Who knows? I mean, who knows what people, I certainly don't know. But I put in the book a moment on December 14th, 1972, when it seems to me, the interpretation is, if anybody reads this, if Nixon suddenly realizes what Kissinger has done with this peace agreement that Hanoi is now jerking Kissinger around with. The North Vietnamese army is going to stay there. We're going to go home. The Democrats in Congress are going to want to cut the aid to South Vietnam. And Nixon,
including military support.
Including military support.
In the air,
notably. Nixon says something, I'm sorry, I don't have it totally memorized, says something like, this isn't a peace agreement. This is an agreement for peace in North Vietnam and continued war in South Vietnam. And Kissinger says, yes, Mr. President. And Nixon is kind of like, you get a sense. And then he's got a question where he says, this is not what we want. We want peace. We want peace. The Vietnamese people have suffered too much. We want peace. Kissinger, silent.
And when you, what Nixon was getting at there was that the kind of retribution that he was able to meet to them with airstrikes in Vietnam, North Vietnam, would be foreclosed by this deal of Kissinger's.
Actually, Nixon used the airstrikes as a way to try to make up for Kissinger's concession. Because in November and December, he promises to the South Vietnamese, because Thieu doesn't want to sign this agreement. Thieu knows exactly what's going to happen. Thieu knows he's been betrayed. But what's he going to do? Who's going to support it? So Nixon says, if you sign the agreement, I will send the B-52s. To North Vietnam and the battlefield in the South. And just like in 72, the combination of your forces on the ground and our air power will prevent Hanoi from conquering your people.
But that was not something that would be permitted under this deal that Kissinger had signed.
No, that could be permitted. Air power could be used.
In North Vietnam.
Because the ground troops are gone.
Okay.
There's no restriction on air power. What happens, though, is the Democrats in Congress in 1973, they pass the War Powers Act. And when Ford becomes president and Hanoi is invading 2 years later, according to its deal with Kissinger, I've got a document on that, too, Ford doesn't send the B-52s. So anyway, so the scenario is January 9, 1971, Kissinger makes a proposal. We have a book from North Vietnamese diplomats, their history of the negotiations, which reports that in late January, like about 2 weeks later, the Soviet ambassador in Hanoi tells the North Vietnamese prime minister, Pham Van Dong, what Kissinger has proposed to Dobrynin, almost word for word. These two Vietnamese, Lu Van Lai, Nguyen An Vo, they put it in their English translation. It's almost the same words. So from Kissinger to the Soviets, from the Soviets to Hanoi. Then, by luck, Frank, I found a memorandum of conversation dated May 25, 1971, which is a meeting of Henry Kissinger and this French guy, Jean Saint-Denis, and some other people. And so they start right off. Following are the highlights of Monsieur Saint-Denis's observations. Hanoi does not fully believe that the Americans will leave Vietnam. If they were assured of that, and of a certain number of seats for the NLF, Viet Cong, in the assembly, they would come to terms on POWs, ceasefire, and the separation of the two Vietnams for a number of years.
This is a key point to which we will return right after a short break. Steve Young has been laying out the facts of a betrayal that haunts us to this day, and that unfortunately has now been compounded by a similar betrayal in Afghanistan, about which we will turn to shortly. Right after these messages, stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We are continuing this hour-long, very special conversation with Steve Young, the author of Kissinger's Betrayal, How We Lost the Vietnam War. It will be out shortly, and I believe is available for pre-order now at Real Clear Books. It's a very, very important book, especially as we mark the 50th anniversary of that betrayal. The so-called Paris Peace Accord signing by Henry Kissinger. Steve, you have laid out in considerable detail how we got to that point. And I think you've got a couple more developments that you want to make sure we chronicle. But it is striking that Kissinger was essentially pursuing, without the knowledge of his boss, the President of the United States, the surrender, effectively, after what I guess came to be called a decent interval. Tell us about that.
Well, no, I've even got a document on a decent interval, Frank, but you just reminded me. So the next thing is evidence, all evidence. In mid-April, right, Kissinger, I just talked about Kissinger has this meeting with Santini on May 25. In mid-April, he has asked our ambassador in Saigon, Ellsworth Bunker, whom I got to know, and I helped him write some memoirs. He says, you know, Ellsworth, please give me your vision for a peace plan to present to Hanoi. So Ellsworth comes up with a peace plan, of which one of his points says, on completion of withdrawal of U.S. forces and exchange of prisoners, all foreign troops would begin withdrawal from the countries of Indochina, NVA from Laos, Cambodia, South Vietnam, Thais from Laos. Such withdrawal to be completed within 6 months, i.e. by March 1973. That's Bunker's plan he sends in to Kissinger. Right? After Kissinger's meeting with Santini on May 25, Kissinger sends this cable back to Bunker, in which he says, on your point six, we will say that the peoples of Indochina should discuss this question among themselves. In other words, the withdrawal question will be discussed between the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese, and the Americans, we have nothing, we're not interested in that. So implicitly, and there's no pressure on Hanoi. We're not asking as a terms of our agreement with Hanoi that they leave. Right? You guys. Right. So then, and the next step is May 31, 1971. And Frank, I want to point out for your audience, all this is happening in the first half of 1971, when we're starting to really win the war in South Vietnam. It's as if Kissinger is living in La La Land. He's oblivious, or he doesn't care. I don't know. But we're starting to make real progress. Hanoi and the communists are in retreat, and Kissinger's doing this secretly. So on May
30, or alternatively, another possibility is that he was so intent on the glory of being the peacemaker that he was prepared to do this deal at the expense of the South Vietnamese and despite the fact that they were gaining a victory.
And in fact, there's a quote from Kissinger, a famous quote with the Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci in 72, which is goes to that very point. He sort of he portrays himself to her as the John Wayne, cowboy, winning the battle all by himself, right? But so anyway, so on May 31, 1971, he meets with the North Vietnamese and he lays down 7 points. And in the 7 points, there's nothing about the North Vietnamese withdrawal. Silent. Then he says, with respect, there's a question, some tweet is asked. With respect to the second question, we believe that the proposal we have made reflects the reality of the current situation. When U.S. forces are finally withdrawn, the political future of South Vietnam will have to be left to the Vietnamese. To go back to Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. And then, without taking time to read it, 3 days earlier, on May 28th, Kissinger sends to Nixon a memo on what he's going to talk to the North Vietnamese about. That sentence about leaving South Vietnam to its fate is not in the report to President Nixon. And then I found in Kissinger, in July, he goes to meet Zhou Enlai, the head of the Chinese Communists. He tells Zhou Enlai the same thing he's told Dobrynin, the same thing he's told Hanoi, what he hasn't told President Nixon. And in a page from his briefing book, he writes, "We want a decent interval."
There we go. So, Steve Young, I have to get this off my chest. I have loathed Henry Kissinger for decades. I believe, as did a remarkable man by the name of Fritz Kramer, who was responsible, he claimed, for discovering Henry Kissinger in the post-World War II German occupation, as I recall, and helping to groom him through Harvard University and for his career as a professor and then ultimately as a government official, who broke with Henry Kissinger, never spoke to him again after his betrayal of South Vietnam. And I believe that Kissinger has gone on over the years to do even more damage in places like the Soviet Union and, of course, in China, most especially. And what you've described here, what you've chronicled, what is now, fortunately, in this important new book, Kissinger's Betrayal, is simply documentation of the degree to which some of the most epic reverses in our history can be laid at Henry Kissinger's feet. And it's revolting, frankly, that he still continues to have the kind of stature and influence in so many circles that he does. We have to take a last break. And when we come back, Steve, I want to bring this point home by talking about how the Kissinger model of betrayal of an ally helped contribute to the endgame of our most recent international fiasco, the surrender of Afghanistan. We'll be right back with the author of Kissinger's Betrayal, Steve Young, on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're concluding our very, very important conversation with a man who has chronicled Henry Kissinger's betrayal of, yes, of course, the people of South Vietnam. I would argue the men and women of our country who suffered and died for their freedom, but also the president he served and our country. Henry Kissinger, then the man credited with having brought about the so-called Paris Peace Agreement. You had two concluding points on Kissinger, and I wanted to give you a chance to make them quickly.
Before we move to, I think you're so right about the continuing failure and disaster of what Henry did for our country. The first is this French guy, Jean Saint-Denis, who I mentioned. He's the guy who comes from Hanoi to tell Kissinger he's got a deal. This is the Frenchman who in 1946, as an operative of De Gaulle, going back to Vietnam to reinstate French colonialism, he picks Ho Chi Minh to be the leader of the Vietnamese. This man who picked Ho Chi Minh, and he's so proud of picking Ho Chi Minh, he's advising the National Security Advisor of the United States. Right? It's appalling.
And Ho Chi Minh, of course, went on to become the communist ruler of North Vietnam, and then ultimately the victor of
and became a hero figure.
The entire country.
The old anti-war movement chant here, you know, ho, 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 Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. We were misled by, our country also got into trouble with a big lie, which we now know it's a big lie because of all these documents. And we're suffering today. The next thing is, the second thing is I asked a historian, sort of described briefly, just recently, what Henry Kissinger, according to his documents, had done. I said, can you think of any precedent in sort of Western history? I mean, this seems to me to be worse than Benedict Arnold. But here's a senior person going against, not getting authority from his president, setting up his country in all probability to lose a war. Now, what kind of a person does that?
Well, it's, again, part of the indictment that I think is long overdue of Henry Kissinger. And I appreciate you bringing the case forward as you have in this new book, Steve Young. Let's pivot quickly to Afghanistan and not only the parallels. You and I worked with Eric Prince and others to promote the idea that a Cords-type approach in Afghanistan might have empowered the villagers there and helped defeat the Taliban as it sought to get the country back. And alas, that was not done. For reasons, among other things, because we had a diplomat who was seeking to emulate Henry Kissinger's great accomplishments in Vietnam.
Why we didn't do it, and Zalmay Khalilzai's negotiating strategy, which was Kissinger's playbook, they both are consequences of our losing South Vietnam, losing the Vietnam War, which I say we need to put at Kissinger's feet. First of all, no Cords program. I mean, I have felt in this, Frank, it could be just, you know, selfishness. But if you had given me the position of a Bill Colby and a Cords program, I could have defeated the Taliban, or you could have defeated the Taliban in 3 years. If you could organize all the Afghan villages and you seal off the sanctuaries in Pakistan, that movement would wither on the vine. We never did it because, and this is my personal experience, year after year after year, our military, our strategic thinkers, our defense intellectuals, our foreign policy, the CIA people, they said we lost in Vietnam. There's nothing to learn there. Turn your back. Ignore it. They overlooked our success. They never figured out how you win a guerrilla. We still don't know how to defeat an insurgency.
And I think we were so completely demoralized by the loss of Vietnam, this sort of legacy that has afflicted successive generations of military officers in our own country, long after those who fought there have passed from the scene, is an affliction as well. It not only meant that we didn't learn the lessons, but we didn't even pursue seriously, it seems, effort to learn them.
Yeah, that our national security elite, our defense elite, were surprised by the Ukrainians. Right? All the Ukrainians were doing was basically on their own, they had their own court strategy. Every Ukrainian, male, female, teenager, grandfather, or grandmother, was a combatant. And they stood down the Russian army.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that winds out. But what we know happened is in the absence of a Cord type approach in Afghanistan, that once the United States pulled out unceremoniously, in a manner very similar to what Biden and his friends did to our forces in Vietnam, we saw the army of Afghanistan come apart at the seams, the government ditto, and in came, of course, the victorious Taliban. The consequences of that, Steve, I guess I would ask you to speculate about, taking into account both the control of that country, the restoration of a safe haven for the jihad, as well as the bequest of, by some estimates, $85 billion worth of very sophisticated American military equipment to the Taliban.
To me, Frank, the worst aspect of abandoning Afghanistan, and let me note that Joe Biden, he abandoned it. He was one of the Democrats who voted to abandon South Vietnam. So he's true to character. As long as we have an elite which believes in abandonment, what other country is going to want to trust us? It's one fact.
It's a sort of working axiom, I think, for sensible people, and that is, if you treat your enemies better than you treat your friends, you will have more enemies and far fewer friends. And that's one of the legacies here.
And then you go deeper, your own willingness, your own courage evaporates. Your own willingness to do the right thing evaporates. Once you could sort of say, well, that was a one-off. That was fate. You do it twice. And it's exactly the same thing that you did. You've now convinced yourself and other people that you do not have what it takes.
Yes. You're not to be trusted, and you will ultimately lose to people who are determined, especially who are evil as well as determined. And that's what we're up against today, I think. We are out of time.
Okay.
Steve Young, I apologize. We are hard out of time, and we have to have you back. When the book is out, we will do a reprise of all of this. And I thank you for your time today, as well as for the expertise and serious scholarship that you've put into telling this story about a man that, as I say, I blame for a lot of America's difficulties at the moment, Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger's Betrayal, How We Lost the Vietnam War, is the title of the book. Check it out, pre-order it now, and come back to us again for more of Securing America next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.